Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos. We are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, and this is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and most intriguing guests. We are the favorite program of hootenoggers, wendigos, skunk apes, and donkey devils, so keep it tuned right here. This hour, let's chat a little bit about revamped Biltmore Village tours under the aegis of Haunted Asheville, hauntedasheville.com. Joshua, obviously, October, big month, biggest month for Haunted Asheville. We were talking a little bit about it during the break, all the guides that you have to employ during the Halloween season and all the mini tours, and we've brought back the Biltmore Village Tour. It's been a few years, I guess, right?
It has, because I originally developed that tour along with a partner at the time. I'm going to say something like maybe almost 10 years ago. And even at that time, though, tourism was not nearly as big in Asheville as it is today. And so we just didn't really have a lot of demand for the Biltmore Village Tour. Everybody wanted to go downtown. And so we would offer it kind of sporadically here and there, and then finally there just wasn't enough interest to offer it at all, with the exception of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. They contact me every Halloween, and they put together a special dinner package on October 31st where they invite their guests to dress up. It's like $100 per person. You have a nice, like, four-course meal. All of it has a Halloween theme. They make some punch and stuff. And then they also take the guests on a haunted Biltmore Village tour, which I have provided for them. And so I've done that on October 31st. But this year, I just started getting so many requests for Biltmore Village, I figured, you know, let's give this another shot. And we're still not going to make it available on a highly consistent basis, which is why if you're listening to this and you're interested in taking a haunted Biltmore Village tour, you better go ahead and book it now. We only have a few dates where this is going to be available, and this weekend is one of those weekends, so is next weekend. It lasts 60 to 90 minutes. One of the cool things about it is it's not just a haunted Biltmore Village tour. It's more of a Biltmore Village mystery tour, because we have things in the tour that are not necessarily related to ghosts but are still really weird. Like, for example, in October of 1981, a kangaroo just appeared hopping around Biltmore Village. Tons of people saw it. There were guys trying to shoot it. And obviously the media came quickly. The authorities got there quickly. And this kangaroo just disappeared. And to this day, nobody has any clue where this kangaroo came from and where it went. Now, I don't know what category. I mean, maybe that has something to do with cryptozoology, because we know that kangaroos are real, but we know they're not supposed to be in Biltmore Village. So there's a cryptid element to it. Could this have been an interdimensional creature of some kind, something that slipped through a portal? You find things on the Biltmore Village tour which are hard to always categorize neatly into a file. So I knew that the guides to deliver the haunted Biltmore tour needed to be real, authentic paranormal investigators who have a lot of experience and who can see the big picture and look at things from many different angles. And so that's why I was thrilled that my friends Missy Hill and, of course, investigator Shelley Wright said, yeah, we'd be happy to deliver some of these tours. And so, as you mentioned, Shelley is doing one tomorrow night at 8 p.m., and Shelley, are you? This is going to be your very first time delivering this tour, right? You must be quite excited.
I am. My first time delivering this particular tour. Mm-hmm. But I have been a guide for you before.
Yes, at the Grow Park Inn, the Pink, right? Lady Tours.
Yeah.
Shelley gets a lot of big tips, by the way. That's a good sign. She gets more than I do when she does a tour. So yeah, you want to pitch how tomorrow night's going to go?
Tomorrow night's going to be so much fun. It's just going to be a big party. We're all going to get together. It's going to be, we're just going to be one big family, and we're going to go out and tell great stories and laugh and get chills, and it's going to be great. It's, what, 60, 90 minutes of just us talking. And I'm sure that people that come on that tour will also have had some personal experiences also. So I'm looking forward to hearing about those.
And you know, it's important to point out that I do get contacted often by people who want to take the downtown classic haunted Asheville tour, but they have a problem walking a long distance over hilly ground, because the downtown tour covers about a mile and a half over 2 hours. And yeah, we are really going up and down some pretty strenuous hills. The Biltmore Village tour, aside from some uneven cobblestone, is about as level and easy as you're going to get for a stroll. So if you're somebody who's wanted to do a walking tour but you have a problem walking, this is definitely the easiest stroll that I can recommend as well.
Definitely. Definitely. And I'll take care of you. I'm not going to make you walk fast. It'll be nice and leisurely, and you're going to have a really good time.
Dates for those tours are on the Asheville or hauntedasheville.com website, I would assume. Mm-hmm. But tomorrow night's Shelley's inaugural tour. Tomorrow night, I think we had a tour down there last night. Missy led one last night, the Friday the 13th tour.
She did a great job.
And so the Sunday the 15th. I always think that there's a there's almost as much significance with a Saturday the 14th and a Sunday the 15th as there is a Friday the 13th.
Should be.
So, Saturday the 14th strikes back.
Sunday the 15th. Yeah, Sunday the 15th with Shelley Wright in Biltmore Village. Go to hauntedasheville.com and book that tour tomorrow night. Yeah, that should be a fun one. And you're right. I was downtown with the wife and kids. This is years ago. I think Jesse was just in his stroller, maybe even when Sylvan was in his stroller. But we went down there and took one of the Biltmore Village tours. I think that Chris was doing it at the time. And we just had a nice leisurely stroll around Biltmore Village. And as Josh points up, it's not strenuous. It's not all the strain of climbing hills like in downtown Asheville. So yeah, if you're kind of a lightweight on the walking end of things, Biltmore Village might be the perfect choice for you. Yeah, you got to do something to get into the Halloween spirit. This hot weather is kind of a bummer. I wanted more cool mornings to kind of make it feel like fall, but it's not feeling like fall when it's 87 degrees out.
No, the evenings are a little bit better, and they'll be breezier, and there won't be as many people in Biltmore Village at that time. So it'll be spooky, it'll be breezy, it'll be good. The atmosphere will be perfect.
And by the way, Vance, I also want to thank you for contributing some of the most fascinating and creepy content that we have on the Biltmore Village tour, because we don't want to spoil it for anybody, but you have been researching a man named William Dudley Pelly for a long, long time. And he is a very controversial figure. He led basically a Nazi sympathizer group in Asheville back during the era around World War II. And I always tell people that if you look at, say, an Indiana Jones movie or Hellboy or one of those movies where they feature these Nazi occultists that are trying to tap into other portals or realms, William Dudley Pelly might be the closest that you're actually going to find to that type of figure, because he was also a spiritualist. You've introduced me to some of his books that talk about contacting the dead. And there is a building there in Biltmore Village that served as his headquarters for a while, where he printed a lot of his material. And for a period, that building operated as a melting pot restaurant. And during that time, I was able to go there and do a Halloween-oriented event and investigation where we found out about all kinds of creepy things that you'll hear about on the tour. But what makes it even more extraordinary is it just so happens that investigator Shelley Wright also worked as a manager at that restaurant. So she has some personal experiences she'll be sharing as well.
You worked at the Melting Pot?
I did.
I think before it was Melting Pot, for just a year or two, it was a Cuban restaurant called Oscar's.
Yeah.
Do you remember when Oscar's was there?
Very good. Ropa Vieja.
Yeah, I liked Oscar's. I don't know if I was ever in the Melting Pot. It seemed like businesses had a hard time hanging on there. And also, that building has a basement level, and a hard rain would flood that basement. I'd say over the years, there's no telling how many times that basement has been full of water.
Weren't you ever curious as to how Shelley got her nickname Fondue Shelley? It was from the melting pot.
When she was working at the melting pot. That makes perfect sense. It all becomes clear. As a matter of fact, that was that building and William Dudley Pelley's association with it is how Joshua and I came in contact, because the aforementioned Lemur Forum, which is collecting cobwebs out there in cyberspace, I went on there and I posted a short message and said, I have some information on a very peculiar character who called Asheville home during the 1930s. And I mentioned the old bank building in Biltmore Village. And Josh wrote back to me, our first correspondent. Josh wrote back and said, I believe I know this building. Could you provide more details about where it was? And I sent back a photo of the old bank building on the square in Biltmore Village. And Josh's response was, I just got a chill down my spine. We held an investigation in that building. We did our big Halloween event there this past year. So, then we kind of zeroed in on some of Pelley's old stomping grounds around Asheville, and everywhere he went, he kind of trailed this miasma of psychic residue. I don't know if those words have ever been strung together.
Miasma. That's a
trailing a miasma of psychic residue.
Wow.
Here on well Speaking done. Of Strange.
That should be a t-shirt.
Go ahead and jot that one down. but that's going to be an interesting tour, and he's a tough guy to tackle. Like Josh said, you know, you go to the Wikipedia entry for him, and the first paragraph is going to drop tantalizing words like Nazi sympathizer and mystic and necromancer, you know, all of these sort of mysterious titles, all true in essence, but I really don't know how to get at the guy proper. But it just so happens that a magazine came to hand just in the last week or so that I think gives us a glimpse at his legacy in layman's terms, and I think I'll share that during the next segment. You are listening to Joshua P. Warren's Speaking of Strange, and we'll be right back. Speaking of strange, this segment, let's delve into some weirdness. I'm a notorious collector of musty tomes, and I got a box full of these old Psychic Observer magazines. I mean, these are kind of rough. That one's like water stain and everything. When I cracked it open, it smelled like grandma perfume, maybe like Florida water. Shelley probably sells Florida water in her shop. Do you carry Florida water?
I do, but I am sold out at the moment.
Sold out of Florida water. Wow, there are a lot of grandmas out there, apparently.
Apparently.
Is Florida water used in exorcisms?
Can be used as an offering on an altar. I have one customer that comes in, he wants Hoyt's cologne and to actually use as a cologne.
There was also like a tobacco cologne that I remember buying at a Botanica in Florida years ago. There's all sorts of weird fragrances associated with this mystical working.
Well, Vance, you might not know this, but most colognes do contain a little scent of tobacco in them. That's what gives it its earthy, woodsy, wintry smell.
Interesting.
Your summers are more of a citrus. Your winters are more of a woodsy tobacco.
Okay.
There you have it.
But anyway, Florida water. Yeah, I cracked into these volumes. They smell like mildew on the outside, but they smell like grandma's house on the inside. And it would stand to reason because the Psychic Observer was a spiritualist publication. First came out in 1938. It was like a weekly newspaper for the spiritualist churches. It was published in Lilydale, New York, and Camp Chesterfield, Indiana, spiritualist hotspots in those days. And it was one of those old guard publications that sort of bridged the gap between the old channeling, the ghost era, and the UFO era, and tried to make the ghosts and the UFOs get along, we'll say. And then shortly after the UFO era came in, 1947-48, you start getting reports of mediums who are channeling extraterrestrial intelligences. So it's a strange blend of UFOs and ghosts in the pages of the Psychic Observer. And this issue from October 1969, do the math, 48 years ago. 48 years ago this month, this issue of the Psychic Observer was published. And here is a rather brief column. Eyewitness, my most memorable psychic encounter. I wish to relate an experience that may be hard to believe and even harder to understand. In 1956, I was doing research, and after some disappointments, I decided to investigate W.D. Pelley of Soulcraft, his difficulties with the New Deal, and the frenzied mudslinging by religious political powers. He was just having too much trouble. To me, it was an open acknowledgement of fear. Though I was threatened when I showed interest, I decided to learn for myself the reasons for such opposition. I certainly learned the true character of people who made every effort to keep their halos brightly shined. I discovered how vicious holy people can be. This urged me on to still greater efforts. I sent for descriptive literature of Soulcraft books and received a 30-page booklet in a business envelope. As I separated it from other mail, I suddenly involuntarily tossed it away from me, feeling in my hand a strange electric-like pain. Again, quickly picking it up, I opened it, racing against time, but had to drop it again. The pain stopped as soon as I realized it. The feeling was not unlike the painful encounters I've had with some ghosts, but I had always thought this pain to be hatred. Now I was not so sure, as it came from an inanimate object. Despite the pain, I was determined to read the booklet. My interest and curiosity rose to a fever pitch. The booklet became a challenge. I kept up my efforts, but could only read three or four lines without dropping it from exhaustion. Crazy! After training for a month, I could hold it for almost 3 minutes. In the second month, I began to review. It kept getting easier until it was no longer much of a challenge. I had already sent for the book, so I passed the booklet on to a very interested friend, saying nothing. I expected to feel his reactions. His immediate reaction was consternation and anger. He even had trouble getting the envelope open. He sent a special delivery letter to the publisher and came to call upon me with anything but benevolent designs on my health. He was instructed to burn the booklet. I feel that part of this puzzle lies in the fact that W.D. Pelley was a strong man both spiritually and psychically, with no doubt, which no doubt could be the same thing. He was doing good work, he had noble aspirations, and received help from high levels of communication. He even received messages from Christ with help of Nostradamus. He put his heart into his work, and he usually sensed the reactions of his readers. I frequently feel reaction to my letters, though I can at all always identify the sharps and the flats, or the source of them. Editor Pelley, however, had feelings so deep that he visited me one night by astral projection when I needed help in understanding what I was so deeply absorbed in studying. I simply cannot understand one aspect of this matter. With Pelley's strong personality and sincerity of purpose, how could his influence or vibrations be covered up or erased by evil entities? I can understand that a lesser person such as myself needs experiences such as these to gain strength, but how could it happen to Pelley? I have other equally unusual experiences to relate, as I recall them. Once I heard a huge police dog talk. Owned by a murderer, he only looked like a dog. Julian M., Chicago, Illinois. Kind of a strange introduction to William Dudley Pelley. Have you ever heard of anyone being psychically affected by a piece of literature or a book, Shelley?
No, I don't. I mean, if it was a used book, I mean, you get things off of that, but not something.
I think you're missing the number one would be the Bible.
Right.
I think a lot of things have
people use it for faith healing, actually smack you on the forehead with a Bible sometimes.
I mean, over the years, a lot of odd things could probably be attributed to reading the scriptures.
Well, you know, I, for years, made a bit of a tradition of reading passages of the Necronomicon on the air. And some people would just turn off the radio for that. It was too much. Just hearing the words.
That was just every time you were on.
Maybe that's what it was. And, well, you know, if you think about it, though, what is more spiritually charged than words, than language that represents thought? And how else do we know about our identity and our origins and all these vast things that are in no other way captured? So, yeah, I think and the Bible is a perfect example of that. I mean, you know, could you imagine what would happen if you desecrated a Bible in public? I mean, people would not like that. So, yeah, it's interesting that some people would attribute a work of Pelley's with that type of power.
Yeah, possibly the writer of this letter, you know, found something scintillating about the content or taboo. Because obviously they expressed that they were familiar with his trials, his notoriety, mm-hmm. as it were, but were determined to expose themselves to this literature that had been verboten, you know. So maybe it's kind of like when a teenage boy from the old school, let's say 1980, gets their hands on a Playboy magazine or something like
or
that.
Or Penthouse Letters.
Wow.
So then you had to just use the words. There
is
was
something
no pictures in there.
Titillating about this literature or something forbidden about it. So the very idea of putting your hands on it might deliver an electric shock. So I think maybe it's an interesting study. And Sam, good call on the Bible. Comparing the Bible to penthouse letters.
No, you are putting words in. They were both brought up.
Yeah, yeah. Drawing them into the same conversation, no, no harm, no foul. But anyway, it's curious to see that some of these people, 4 years after Pelley's death, 1969, were willing to forgive and accredit him. He's almost universally damned, we'll say. And so maybe,
as most Nazi sympathizers are.
Maybe next segment I'll play devil's advocate for just a little bit and see what the far-reaching appeal of this wicked character is. It's Speaking of Strange. We'll be right back. Speaking of Strange, sometimes we throw our own little mind riot around here. We're on the trail of William Dudley Pelley, a man who it's difficult to summarize. He was once called the most dangerous man in America. He spent 7.5 years in federal prison for it, sedition charges, specifically wartime sedition, sentenced in 1942 for impeding the war effort, publishing literature directed at active servicemen intended to cause mutiny or for them to somehow look at the war effort as not worthy and turn their backs on their military duties. There's a word for insubordination. Yeah, that's it. Literature intended to cause the insubordination of military personnel. 7.5 years in federal prison. A wartime sedition charge that, even though the war was over in 1945, kept him in the pen until 1950. Yeah, he made some powerful enemies. He was relentless in his attacks on Franklin Roosevelt, specifically Jews. In general, yeah, that's probably where the Nazi sympathizer thing comes in, because well, basically Franklin Roosevelt, in the eyes of a lot of these American Nazi sympathizers, was a Jew. Have you ever heard any such talk that Franklin Roosevelt was a Jew? That was one of Pelley's things. He liked to refer to him as Rosenfeld.
Well, the Nazi sympathizers, it seems like they like to say that everybody that they don't like is Jewish.
Yeah.
That seems to be one of their traits.
Pelley's thing was he was in Siberia during the Russian intervention after World War One, and there were Czech forces over there. There were Japanese forces, and the United States had a small role in that Siberian intervention, but Pelley was over there as a YMCA canteen scout. But he kicked around with a lot of these old White Guard Russians, the Tsarist loyalist army versus the Bolsheviks. And he claimed that everybody he was running into on the czarist side, you know, the anti-Bolshevists, were claiming that the Bolshevists were Jewish. And he came home and found people like Henry Ford publishing things like The International Jew. And he kind of fed into this sort of a stewing anti-Semitism that was popular in the United States in the late teens, early 20s. Only he had this sort of obsessive, fanatical personality that he just hammered on it. So until 1928, until about 1928, he had been working in Hollywood and working on the payroll of some very influential folks. Carl Laemmle, who was a producer out there in Hollywood, produced some of the early Lon Chaney films. Pelley worked with him. He was in the office after he made a movie for Lon Chaney called The Shock that was a huge box office hit. And Lon Chaney Sr. walks into Carl Laemmle's office and says, I just made you a heap of money. What's next? And Carl Laemmle said, anything you want, Lon. And Lon said, how about we make The Hunchback of Notre Dame? And Carl Laemmle reportedly said, no, Lon, I don't think that's a good deal. Football pictures are going nowhere this year. But, of course, after Lon Chaney explained to Carl Laemmle that The Hunchback was... from French literature and not a quarterback for the Fighting Irish. He did make The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and the rest, as they say, is history. But Pelley was a good friend of Lon Chaney out there, and Lon Chaney was, he observed Pelley's growing overt anti-Semitism, which probably didn't sit too well in Hollywood in those days with a lot of the... studio bosses and things. So in 1928, he had a out-of-body experience, we'll call it that, and he wrote about the episode where he had encounters with deceased loved ones and friends in a magazine article, the American Magazine. It was like a Saturday Evening Post or a Cosmopolitan. It was a Red Book, any of these popular newsstand periodicals with circulation in the millions. He wrote an article called 7 Minutes in Eternity, delineating his experiences when he, quote-unquote, died and went to heaven for actually several hours. The title, 7 Minutes in Eternity, refers to when he woke up in the company with some deceased friends and he seemed quite shocked and stunned and was, craning his neck around to take in his surroundings. And they said, calm down, relax, old boy. Don't try to see everything in the first 7 minutes. But he was actually there for what accounts for several hours during the night. Became one of the first popular published accounts of an out-of-body experience. Pelley had already been a short story writer and had written something like 200 published short stories in all the popular news periodicals, and that's why he had access to the American Magazine to publish this nonfiction account. It pretty much ended his mainstream writing career. He took a turn towards spiritualism after that. He said something like 30,000 letters came to the offices of the American Magazine asking him to provide more insight because he left it with the idea that in the weeks since the experience, he had developed clairaudience. It was as if these past souls that he encountered during that experience were communicating with him through his psychic ear.
So that's like clairvoyance, but audio only?
Yes. You're hearing the voices of a discarnate entity. And some of these entities, he claimed, were ascended masters or higher mentors. So the level of information he was sharing was pretty profound and effective to some of these spiritualist-minded people, and they began to subscribe to some newsletters, magazines that he started to publish shortly after that. So there was his launch into self-publishing. He went from a mainstream writer for the popular press to a sort of a fringe self-publisher. And by 1933, with the rise of Adolf Hitler, he was in Asheville, North Carolina, to announce the Silver Shirt Legion of America, which was a kind of like, well, a shirt organization, much like Hitler's brown shirts, and modeled in part after Hitler's brown shirts. The Silver Shirts had branches all over the country, and they paraded, and they didn't wave swastikas, but their animosity towards the Jews was a parallel to what was going on in Nazi Germany during the 1930s. So you have to imagine this is 1933, and there were Americans who were sympathetic to Hitler. Maybe not.
This was in Asheville?
Yeah, he had relocated to Asheville because he started a metaphysical college here. Actually, it was in the women's clubhouse out there at the corner of Sunset Parkway and Charlotte Street.
Huh.
That's been recently restored. So he had a metaphysical college there in the summer of 1932. By 1933, with Hitler coming to power in Germany, he starts this Silver Shirt, this paramilitary organization. Federal authorities are investigating a branch out in California by 1934 for attempting to purchase rifles and machine guns from the U.S. Marines on the West Coast. So they kind of get into this early militia movement, MILU. As I mentioned, he goes to prison for sedition for 7.5 years, and when he gets out, the first thing he publishes is a book called Starguest, which kind of gets him in on the ground floor of the whole ancient alien theory. He helps to popularize the idea that there is no missing link to be found here on Earth because our remote ancestors came from the stars. And that theme is echoed in a lot of UFO literature to this day. So Pelley had his finger in so many elements on the fringe, so many unsavory elements. And in 1939, he published something like 8 million pieces of literature in that building on the square down in Biltmore Village. 8 million pieces of propaganda.
That's a lot of printer ink.
Yeah. So, we certainly can lay claim, whether we like it or not, to one of the most notorious and fascinating characters in America, frankly. And we'll be right back after this break with more Speaking of Strange. It's Speaking of Strange. I'm Vance Pollock, your host. Shelley Wright's over here. Sam the Animal Steele's here. Joshua P. Warren's here. Yeah, we were talking about all these nasty Nazis in Asheville back in the 30s. I want to tell folks that there weren't that many silver shirts in Asheville.
Are you standing up for them, Vance? What are you trying to do?
I'm just saying I'm defending Asheville's good name. Okay. There were not that many Pelly supporters in Asheville. He was a reluctant guest in Asheville for about a decade. The local newspapers and media and establishment did not like him too much. Although I've been told that in the police and sheriff's department, he did have a lot of supporters because he was sort of part of a vigilante organization. A lot of those guys were coming from a Ku Klux Klan background. So, local law enforcement was all right with him.
What the, because I knew the Klan was big in this area at the time, like, how did they and the silver shirts get along? Is there like a crappy people dislike there? Did they get along? Like,
no, apparently they got along pretty good, the local law enforcement on the street level. But when you get up into the courts, the judges and attorneys and the movers and shakers were not fond of William Dudley Pelly, but apparently the guys in the street were, you know, they're itching for action, and they kind of like this. Oh yeah, revolution sounds good to me. he was that sort, and he did appeal, even though he was sort of an aristocratic figure, a society figure, with wealthy widows at his elbows. He appealed to these kind of gritty, angry guys. I did read an article recently where he disavowed former membership in the Ku Klux Klan. He was announced to have been a former Klansman, and he came out quite emphatically to say, no, I was never in the Ku Klux Klan, nor do I intend to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And that's one thing about it. You hear that somebody's an anti-Semite, a Nazi, hates the Jews. You just automatically assume white supremacist, right? Well, here's a strange thing. There was a colored chapel of the Silver Shirts.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it wasn't specifically aimed at blacks. And you read all this literature, and there's reams and reams of this literature, and he was not particularly anti-black or anti-Japanese. He loved the Japanese, as a matter of fact. That's another thing that got him in trouble with the authorities.
Not a popular viewpoint probably in the 40s there.
No. So, just had trouble with the Jews, but he was rather indoctrinated with that during wartime. Like I say, during the Siberian intervention, I remember my father being viciously anti-Japanese because he had been in the Pacific during World War II.
He hated the vapors.
If you're gonna teach somebody to go kill somebody, you better teach them to hate them. You're not going to kill somebody, that you don't hate. Hopefully,
you like how he put that "hopefully" at the end.
Hopefully. He's like, no, hopefully. Don't kill the ones you love. And if you can't,
don't
kill
paint yourself
the
into
ones
a corner,
you love, baby. Love the
hate
ones
the ones
you with.
Here.
I don't know. I thought that
where
was
are you going
somewhere.
With this?
I don't
man.
Know.
Yeah,
I totally lost.
It's mid-October. How about a good old campfire story?
Yeah, we should have some of those. But do you know about Senator Robert Rice Reynolds?
No.
R. Bob. Josh, do you know anything about Senator Reynolds?
I certainly do. He's associated with one of the curses in Asheville that we talk about on the Haunted Asheville tour.
Sure.
The Hope Diamond has a very odd connection to Asheville. Of course, most people have heard that the Hope Diamond is cursed. There are lots of bizarre things that have occurred connected to that diamond that seem to transcend mere coincidence. And, of course, Asheville's largest mass murder killing spree happened in 1906 when Will Harris went on a rampage, and that ended in 6 deaths, including his own. And during the rampage, there was a judge in Asheville who happened to be out drinking late at night. Judge Reynolds, who always kept a .38, I believe it was, in his vest pocket. And he came out and took a few shots at Will Harris. They traded shots back and forth. Neither man hit the other. And then finally, the judge popped back in. And he was unscathed, even though he said some of the bricks fell down on his head, or some pieces of bricks came down on him from Will Harris's shots landing over his head. So he considered himself to be a very lucky man. And the rest of his life, people talked about the great fortune of Lucky Judge Reynolds. So it's very ironic that years later, his brother would become the United States Senator from Asheville. And, of course, many people in the area have heard of the Reynolds Mansion, which is a very haunted place. And during the time that the Reynolds Mansion was in sort of its heyday, one of the owners actually came into possession of the Hope Diamond and may have brought the curse of the Hope Diamond to Asheville. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about that before we dive straight into the Dark 30 Hour coming up next.
Yeah, it promises to be a seedy, surly, unseemly Dark 30 this evening on Speaking of Strange. Stay with us. We'll be right back.